ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The United States of America is a confounding place of triumph and tragedy, of high-minded statements of principle and the most appalling hypocrisy, of vaulting ambition for the equality of all, but the reality of slavery and racism. It's the country which came to be labelled by others as exceptional, and indeed, American exceptionalism has become a bedrock of American belief. It showed us more than any other country the results of inventiveness and the successes of industrial capital. Yet it also continues to perpetuate division and misery for many of its population. After the Second World War, America seemed a beacon for freedom and the limitless possibilities of life. There was the New Deal and the ideals of the Great Society, and then came the Vietnam War. Later, the collapse of the Soviet Union seemed to promise a new world order. Led by America, emotions ran high. "Yes, we can," said Obama. And then came Donald Trump. What can we make of America? One of our best speechwriters and historians, Don Watson's written a personal view of the conundrums in his book, The Shortest History of the United States. And he joins us this evening. Don, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Good evening.
It is, as I said, a confounding place. Where does one begin? It's often been said that one of the keys to understanding America is that its destructive civil war, in which, well, over 500,000 people were killed, never really ended, despite Lincoln's victory in 1865, and that the divisions of the Civil War simply got put to one side, papered over, and it still goes on. What do you think of that observation?
I think it's substantially true, but you can add to it. That is, you know, America is held together throughout its history by compromise, sometimes by quite desperate compromise. You know, it's an unusual country in that it is built really on ideas, the ideas of the Enlightenment. Welded to ideas of Christianity, really, and those ideas went into a constitution and a Declaration of Independence and a Bill of Rights, which really consists of amendments to the Constitution. And it's through the constant regurgitation of those ideas and the sort of sacralization of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, that's what America hangs on, and somehow it has managed to hold together. If you want to ask me what the miracle of the United States is, it is that it actually still exists. Mm. That the more you look at it, the more you think, well, it nearly fell apart very soon after it began. There were compromises right from the beginning. The great compromise at the beginning is that it's built on the notion of the natural rights of humankind, and that we're all born equal, but the first seven presidents are slaveholders, and it can do nothing about slavery, even though the founders are aware that slavery might be the wound that brings them all undone, pardon me. And that we can leave aside the fact that the female section of the population are also left out. And before we say, oh, yes, but that was the 18th century, Mrs. Adams, the wife of the second president, had no doubt about it when she said to her husband, you know, really, the greatest tyranny is the tyranny of men over women. So, but they're not really the things that divide it from time to time is how you sort of reconcile the slave interest with the northern free interest. Mm. So they're trying – by the time when they get to 1849, John Calhoun, a slave owning, a great advocate for slavery, a Southerner, of course, says that within three presidential terms there must be a civil war, and sure enough, he was absolutely right. The civil war breaks out in 1861, and then there's the compromise that follows that Lincoln's emancipated the slaves, And Reconstruction begins with great verve and determination, but in the end everyone gets sick of it, really. The Southerners hate it. The Klan is born. Horrendous organization, the Klan. The president, Ulysses S. Grant, puts the Klan to flight for a while, but then Grant dies. The Klan comes back bigger and stronger than ever. Jim Crow is born, which is a sort of terrorist apartheid that operates in the South under, if you like, this veneer of old world gentility in the plantation economy. So the compromise is followed. And if you think of all the competing forces in America, God and mammon, labor and capital, the states versus the feds, slavery and non-slave and abolition, you can go on and on. It's quite remarkable that it has managed to stay together.
Because it gets founded on these high ideals, doesn't it? And the, you know, this sweeping, overarching rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence, the writing of the Constitution of the United States. We hold these truths to be self-evident: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because it only ever applied to some people, and as you said, George Washington was a slave owner. Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. So many of them were. And you get a sense, too, with the same with the Protestant religions that founded America, too, that arrived there, the dissident Protestant religions, that they were able to hold these ideas of heaven and mammon, that is, heaven and earth, in their heads simultaneously.
Yeah.
And that's a key to understanding America as well, that don't necessarily look at what I say, look at what I do, and then make a judgment.
Yeah, and there are contradictions within them. I mean, in one sense, there are two affects in American life. One is the communitarian, God-fearing, Protestant sort of regime, mental regime that came out of the Northeast, the Puritan founders. And out of that came some really important parts of American life, both the purely religious, the idea of grace, of being, building communities in the eye of God. We shall be as a city upon a hill. You mentioned the rhetoric. America is sort of born in the world of Milton and Shakespeare and the King James Version of the Bible, and this marvelous rhetoric, language that America is born in, actually continues all the way through to at least Obama. And we can come back to Trump on that, because one of the things that Trump has actually destroyed is American language. He doesn't care two hoots about it. No, that's not. Obama speaks in those Lincolnian cadences. Biden, somewhat. He was having trouble speaking at all, as we know. But Trump undermines all that, much as he doesn't pay any kind of respect to the founding fathers or the monuments or the icons of American life. But you have that on the one hand, and you have on the other the plantation economy built on slavery, the world of cotton, where cotton is king, and other things like indigo and tobacco and so on. But so they're two different aims right at the beginning, but neither side is perfectly itself. In other words, the God-fearing North are very commercially inclined, and although they oppose slavery in principle, they actually deal in slaves, and they enslave Indians, and they send slaves off, and they buy slaves in. And down South, while they're sort of shamelessly exploitative, religion is a powerful force. In the South.
This is a big difference, it seems to me, when you look at the history of our country. Say, for example, we're both colonial societies, and in that sense, that I remember Manning Clark in his epic history of Australia said one of his great themes was the struggle, for how you live without God, and that this was one of the great themes of Australian life, the struggle between God and mammon, and how you could derive meaning and live without and build a society without God. But America, that was never been a theme in America. It's always been a society under God from its beginnings, and they were very powerful. You point to the sweeping religious revivalist movements of the 18th century and the 19th century, and you know we saw it in the 20th year with Billy Graham coming out to this country. But this religious fervor in America that's never been a thing here in Australia is a marked difference between us, isn't it?
Yes, there is, but it's different in many, many ways. But bear this in mind, that the founders were heavily influenced by the Enlightenment. Mm. They were effectively deists, most of them. That is, they believed, I mean, they had various beliefs. Benjamin Franklin probably was a deist, you know, but they were unwilling really to renounce God altogether. Jefferson was a deist, meaning God created. The literal definition of deism, as I understand it, is basically, well, there was a creator, but he sort of lost control of things. So they were concerned about the separation, that there would not be an established church. Mm. This was important to them. That has changed over the years. And certainly it's out of control now. But what was... The sort of Protestant traditions in America, which run for a very long while and they're stimulated by the awakenings, this idea that there has to be some transcendent force in the United States. For the most part, it's God, but then the transcendentalists and transcendentalist philosophers like Emerson and Thoreau see somehow in the experience of America itself, there is a sort of transcendent force. So while that's going on, there is also coming out of the frontier this idea of, and it's coming out of capitalism eventually too, is the idea of self-support, that an American should be a self-supporting individual, someone who has conquers the physical world, and that pragmatic values are what really matter. So the sort of ideal American becomes, look, you know, there are a dozen ways to, you use the word confounding, which is exactly the right way. Mm. So, you know, one can say the ideal American is this, but then you can look somewhere and say, well, that's all nonsense. But really, the American is a self-supporting individual with a respect for God, that he's aware of where he stands in creation. But he conquers himself, and he conquers the physical world around him.
Hmm. It's an important strain in American life, isn't it? And I thought there were some parallels here with our own. Americans talk about the frontier, and they're talking about, you know, west of the Appalachians when they open up the Great Plains of America and, you know, the wagon trains, all that mythology I think that all of us have grown up with, through Hollywood, of cowboys and stagecoaches and fights within Indians and guns and all of that. The idea that Americans were hardy and reliant and with God at their side and the Bible as their companion, they managed to build new societies and new lives, all of which is true. They did, you know, at the cost, of course, massive cost of the local populations. But this idea that Americans therefore are, as you say, independent and self-supporting, even though, of course, for most Americans, this wasn't life at all. I mean, life was and remains in the cities. This has parallels with us here in Australia, doesn't it? But with our notions of the outback too, because a lot of Australians dig or drink from this well. The idea that, you know, we too are a doughty people, conquering fire and flood and other pestilence.
Yes, there's a couple of essential differences. I mean, there was the famous historical thesis of Frederick Jackson Turner around the end of the 19th century that took hold of the American historical imagination for a long while. And that was that out of the frontier, out of the physical frontier, there came a set of ideas, which we've just been talking about, that were transmitted back to the cities and to, for that matter, the elites, and into the whole American worldview. And they were, as we said, about the self-supporting individual, the log cabin to White House sort of thesis, that anyone could get there if he and she worked hard, was prepared to endure and persevere and invent, they would find a way, so that the physical world of America became the sort of intellectual world of America. In Australia, according to the old Australian historian Russell Ward, it worked rather differently, that the frontier produced a kind of communitarian ethic. Russell Ward was an old lefty, of course, and he was saying we didn't have that individualist notion that the Americans had, the rugged individualist. We had a communal ethic, so that out of the shearers and the stockmen of the and the bush workers of the 1890s, we got trade unionism and a labour party. We got a labour movement, a collectivist movement. Now, both they're theories. They don't explain everything, and they may only be partially right. There's some truth in Ward's thesis, I think. The only thing is, when you look at America, the American labour movement, it was tough here. There were lockouts and a few shots were fired. A few boats were burnt on the Murray and the Darling. But in the United States, the labour movement was just crushed. I mean, the Pinkerton's agents, the National Guard, the goons, they just simply broke heads and drove the unions into the ground. And it was years before the unions really recovered from that. But that tough as it was on the Australian, in the Australian labour movement as it was founded, it was 10 times tougher in the United States. They just, American capital just would not have them.
It's interesting, isn't it? I remember reading Obama's book about his time as president, and he was talking about health care. This really puzzles many Australians, I think. They think, why on earth does the richest country on earth not have a decent health care system? And, you know, it seems such a no-brainer. Why wouldn't you do that? And it seems to me that part of it goes back to this idea you're talking about, this lack of an idea of collectiveness in America, that, as Obama observes in his book, once you start to drill into it, a lot of people do have health care in America. They don't see why they should be providing it to others necessarily. And this is a curious sort of thing for a God-fearing society too. Again, it's these contradictions, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, and you know, you can go back into the United States and find, well, even among the Puritan founders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and so on, you know, they were hard, but basically the core unit was the family and the community, you know, with a bunch of elders ruling the whole show. But even out of that came people of a more radical disposition, like Roger Williams, who went off to Rhode Island and did things like recognized native title, allowed people to come and worship as they pleased, was way more radical than most of the Republican Congress now. There were lots of communitarian ideas in the foundations of America. But in a way, the struggle has often been between those two competing notions. And that really comes to a head in the 1930s with Roosevelt. Roosevelt's New Deal, basically, as the left would say, he saved capitalism. He also saved American democracy, liberal democracy. But the New Deal deeply offended the conservative American thinkers, a lot of American capitalists. An absolute horror, the idea that you would create employment for people, that you would pay unemployment benefits. Now, millions of Americans were grateful for what Roosevelt did. Among them was Lyndon Baines Johnson, who worked in one of the New Deal programs. But conservative America really never stopped wanting to unwind the New Deal, which in a way seems strange because under Roosevelt, despite a few mistakes, or probably a couple of bastard acts, Roosevelt actually did save the democracy. He modernized the American state. He managed to turn the country around so dramatically that it went from isolationist to winning the war. And in the meantime, even before he committed troops, he was providing most of the material needs for both the Russians and the Western, the Allies. So, and that is one of the great phenomena of history, it seems to me, what American industry managed to produce out of factories which until then had been producing cars and other consumer goods. They were turning out tanks and aeroplanes at a phenomenal rate. And then Roosevelt basically sets up the framework. He and people like George Marshall sets up the framework for the post-war world. And yet, all through the 50s and 60s, and right up until now, really, there have been the right wing in America has been dedicated to the notion that we Americans are a self-supporting people, and that's the way it must always be. And anything else is socialism and to be damned.
Don Watson's with us, one of the country's best writers and historians. He's written a personal, it's an necessarily idiosyncratic view of the history of America in his new book, The Shortest History of the United States. It's a terrific read if you want to get one person's view of what happened in the United States. One of the other things that seems to be unique, I don't know whether it's unique to America, but it's an outstanding characteristic of it, is its notion of American can-do. You know, America's had a chutzpah, a confidence, a brashness that you look at Australia, for example. I'm not sure, apart from sporting braggadocio, we do have, that Australians perhaps intrinsically mistrust ourselves in a way that Americans don't. They think, of course, we can get it done. And their can-do, of course, has led to, well, I mean, they're probably, I would think undoubtedly, the most inventive, country that the world's ever seen in terms of its patents, its inventions, its dominance of technology. Where does that idea come from? Is that, again, this frontier idea, or where does it come from?
It's hard to put, a finger on one thing. Part of it is the Republic, America is America. The United States is the United States. It owes fealty to no one. In Australia, until not so long ago, most of the companies, major companies operating in this country, were branch offices of Britain, and they really didn't run research stuff. We were in a way hogtied, and the fact. I really don't want to go down this particular avenue, but the fact of our owing our loyalty to the British Empire was not helpful in this regard. It affects your mindset, but it also quite literally stopped us doing things. Looking to an Asian market for instance. And so on. Whereas the Americans never had those sorts of inhibitions. No. It believed from the beginning that, yes, it can do. We can build our own houses. We can do whatever. I know half a dozen Americans who have built their own house.
Yeah.
I mean, God knows how they did it. I know one who built one here. There's a sort of The can-do, that's the can-do. The self-supporting thing is powerful. The frontier notion is powerful. And the fact that they brought millions of people from Europe. I mean, one of our difficulties is that the voyage to Australia in the 19th century was such a long one. With the American clipper ships from about 1860 on, I might be out for a few years here, you could cross the Atlantic in 8 days. You know, you shot across. Mm. So where are you going to go? And Australia's convict until about 1850. Are you going to go to a convict society or are you going to go to a free society? You know what you're going to choose. So millions of Europeans migrate to the United States. They bring their ingenuity with them. They bring all their drive with them. They're escaping. They bring an idea of freedom which has never really been so big here. Americans talk a lot about freedom, and to the point where we often think it's just a bit of a pain in the neck, quite frankly, and not really meant or hypocritical or whatever. But it actually has it's a powerful notion in the United States. It means something because people came there for the freedom that it offers. I think it's still palpable. I still think there is a sense of freedom in the United States that you don't get in Australia. You're free. You're as free here as you are there, and maybe freer. But freedom is a sort of, it's a kind of modus operandi in America. And I think that's helped. Plus, there's an enormous buildup of capital. In the last part of the 19th century and into the 20th, the patents are extraordinary.
Yes, they just are.
They're inventing everything.
They have. In the modern era, of course, they have invented everything. They were the first inventors of the supercomputer. And now they control the world's most powerful computer chips. I mean, they're the inventors of the world's most powerful computer chips.
Well, there's a very strong parallel in more ways than one than the sort of titans of industry of the late 19th century, of the Gilded Age in America. The Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Mellons and so on. And and now with the tech bros and the sense now that really they should be running the show. The captains of industry in the 19th century felt the same way.
They felt and the they same
really,
way.
They, and they did run the show, really, until...
Interestingly, until they were broken up, weren't they? And then until their great monopolies were broken up. So it's not as though it hasn't happened before in the US. It has.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Roosevelt and Taft and Wilson all were trust busters.
Yeah.
Biden was trying the same thing. He wanted to sort of weaken the big corporations, Google and so on, but he never got very far. And then, of course, we saw the result the moment Trump got the job. The tech brothers were down to Mar-a-Lago like a shot and sitting at his knee.
Can I get just some pen portraits of some of who you would regard as the consequential American presidents? I mean, a lot of people point to Theodore Roosevelt as one of those. Would you share that view?
He was quite a character, Teddy. An amazing man. I would put him in the second rank. I'd put in the first rank Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln.
And Lincoln, yeah.
And FDR. Franklin Roosevelt, I would put in the absolute first rank. 20th century, I think Roosevelt's a complete standout. And interesting, he's the one I would get Anthony Albanese to read about.
FDR.
Yeah. Because he doesn't begin as a radical. He's not a radical. He seems radical to people who have been backing Hoover and don't actually... can't imagine how to handle the Depression. And Roosevelt takes on the ideas of John Maynard Keynes and tries to think we have to inflate the economy. We have to get people back to work under any, by any means possible. And he staves off the populist left of Huey Long, and he staves off the quasi-fascist right. And America survives, and millions of lives are saved as a result. I mean, that is their livelihoods, at least. He changes America fundamentally, and he says as he goes, and I think this is really important, he comes to understand within 3 or 4 years, and he says, if you're going to govern a country and you know what it needs, you have to be at it all the time. You can't stop. You have to stay ahead of your opponents, real and potential. You have to keep doing things. And I think that is good advice for Labour governments, at least, and probably good advice for all governments.
Mm. It's plenty of people are offering that advice to Anthony Albanese at the moment. Can we talk about, you mentioned those first-rank presidents and Theodore Roosevelt you put in the second rank. I've always been intrigued by LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
I put him in the second rank too.
He seems to be one of those presidents, and you know, with his ideas of the Great Society, which you know, he, as you said, he studied at the feet of FDR. That his ideas for that in the 60s, and he was a consummate politician, LBJ. But of course, the Vietnam War got him because it just crueled everything, and his ambition was torched by. But he had vaulting ideas for America, LBJ, didn't he?
Totally. I mean, I think he was. I think he's not underrated. And now he was certainly underrated at the time. Vietnam completely undid him. He just couldn't understand why they weren't winning, and then he couldn't understand what was going on with Americans in the streets protesting. It was just a terrible blind spot. He was getting very bad advice. As we were, you know, from Westmoreland and people who kept saying they were winning. It's a strange, tragic sort of business for Johnson because his domestic efforts were really exemplary. His Civil Rights Act and his, at some cost, you know, he knew what the cost would be to the Democratic Party in the South to pass the Civil Rights Act. And this Great Society, he did more in 18 months or so than Obama did in 8 years. Mm. Clinton did. His social policy record is really second to none, with perhaps FDR as the exception.
We could play what-ifs, of course, and they're always fun in history, but you make an important point about discussing the Kennedys, but in particular Robert Kennedy, that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, as we know, by Sirhan Sirhan, but may well have... Look, we don't know, but he may have gone on to win the nomination and the presidency, and if he had, would America be a different place now? Because he would have brought together the South and the conservatives and the North in a way that other presidents, particularly Nixon, of course, did not.
Yes, there are dozens of what ifs, as we know, but the Kennedy one interested me because it was like use the term inflection point. It's like this moment in American history where it went the other way and Nixon won, and not by a huge amount against Hubert Humphrey. He wasn't wasn't the worst guy who ever ran for the job. Mm. But Kennedy had such momentum, and he had this sort of couple of months of zooming around the country into places where presidents never went. He forms a close friendship with Chavez, the leader of the Mexican sort of workers in the agricultural fields of California. It's as if somewhere Robert Kennedy saw the light and went from being this hard-ass attorney general and the straightener in his brother's cabinet, trying to keep JFK on the straight and narrow.
Keep his pants on for a start.
Yes, a hard job with the JFK. But I don't think Robert was entirely innocent himself, but he did straighten himself out eventually. He becomes a very interesting character. And I suppose it's also in the fact that the death seems so pointless.
Yeah.
I mean, this fellow just sort of wanders up and shoots him for no particular reason.
For no particular reason, no.
It's over Israel. And but, it just came out of the blue. It was a terrible year. Martin Luther King had been shot as well. At that point, you felt America. I remember it and thinking, I was 20 or something, but thinking, this country's going down the drain.
Mm.
And then Nixon, who was a rabid socialist by comparison with his later Republican president, Nixon is corrupt. Watergate is it. He brings shame on the office and shame on the country in a way. So it takes a long while for the US to recover from that moment. And you just think, well, if Kennedy had got in there full of zeal and high purpose,
things might have been different.
It might have been different. It needed a kind of Lincoln figure at that moment, and it didn't get one.
Yeah, true. I'm talking with Don Watson about his book, his history of the United States, shortest history of the USA. You might like to pose questions if you want. Plenty of people have on the text line. 1-300-800-222 is my number. 0467 922702. If you want to send a text.
Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Disappointing presidents, Don. Would you put Barack Obama here? Because he comes in with all this "yes, we can" optimism. He's one of the great rhetoricians of American political life, and yet, does he achieve much?
No, well, he's disappointing, and it's partly because there seemed so much promise in the election of a progressive black politician at the end of a fairly ugly period post 9/11 with the neocons and the war on terror. There was, he spread the gospel of hope, and there was hope. I think where he went wrong was in the first 12 months. I think he was very reluctant, understandably, to rock the boat too much. He didn't want to look like an angry black man.
Mm.
He understood, I'm sure, that he and his wife and children in the White House was not welcomed by a very large number of his fellow Americans. And Trump was quickly onto that with his birther stuff. But I think when he allowed it to at least seem, and really in materially it was the case, that he bailed out the banks and failed to bail out their victims. And effectively, Obamacare aside, he managed to leave the ground that Trump made his own uncontested by the Democrats until Bernie Sanders came along.
Mm.
So it's hard on Obama in a way, but I think the realities of America sort of were more than he could handle. When he said, for instance, that in other countries, he questioned that exceptionalism you spoke about. When he said, though, I'm sure people feel the same in other countries, that their country's exceptional, he was forced to sort of backtrack on that within a month or two because the commentariat came down on him so hard. And he continued to prosecute American wars abroad. He managed to clean up Osama bin Laden, but he was hawkish, as Americans had come to expect, but that left him in 2016. It left the Democrats with a hawk as a candidate in Hillary Clinton, And Trump able to say these forever wars, we've got to get out of them. It's a waste of time. Why are we sacrificing American lives? These countries don't appreciate what we're doing. We should never have fought them. So Trump ran as the dove in 2016.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? So where do we put Donald Trump? Because, I mean, America seems in political paralysis at the moment. It seems hopelessly, it's almost evenly divided between those who think Donald Trump represents the future and those who don't. And there's absolutely no meeting ground. I mean, it made me wonder, with reading your book, was America like this in the past, in the middle of the 19th century, perhaps? Well, I think, in other words, this is not new in America.
No, well, I think it's true. I think Trump he's an exceptional lunatic and a very strange man. But it would be a big mistake to think he's not a chip off the block. Not of the whole country, but he's a chip off a part of the block. America has never been short of shysters and hucksters and kleptocrats and ratbags and humbugs and plain bad actors. You know, Washington warned about it. All the founders were aware in one way or another that the whole caboodle could tip over if one badly disposed person got control. And Trump really is that person. And it's interesting that he shows no affection or respect for any of those norms of American life, including for the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. You know, knocking down the East Wing of the White House is just one of many, many, many acts of contempt for tradition in America. His language is contemptuous of American language. His use of social media and so on. And yet what he did was to recognize the reality of the political culture in 2016. Social media had become the way ideas were transmitted. Being on the media all the time was what mattered, not what you said, just be the news. He learnt that. So, you know, he said all sorts of outrageous things and people said, oh, that's the end of him. It wasn't, because he was the news then and he was the news in the next hour and the next hour and the next hour. In a funny kind of way, Trump is sort of like the anti-history person. Not just that he's anti what happened in American history, but he doesn't recognise history. His whole political style is about the moment. You know, this is what's happening now.
We started this conversation by asking whether the one way to understand the American nation was to recognise that the Civil War had never been resolved. There are plenty of commentators who wonder whether there may well be another one, given the polarities in the US at the moment and the seeming lack of any common ground between Trump and these MAGA supporters and the rest, and, you know, the rest are sometimes a motley crew. Do you think that's even remotely likely?
Oh, I think it's not impossible. I give myself this much credit for it. I actually did think that Trump could win in 2016. It was only the polls, which consistently showed Hillary winning, that made me not. God, I could have been a hero. I could have said Trump will win, and he did. No one did think he could win, and I thought he could win, and in fact, I thought he would win in 2024 when everybody wanted, so desperately wanted, everyone I knew desperately wanted Kamala to win. But I thought that if he won again, given what had happened on January the 6th, the invasion of the Capitol and everything, given what Project 2025 said they would do, that is, hugely expand the powers of the executive, take on all those kingly powers that were left there by the Constitution, much greater powers even before Trump got hold of them than any monarch in Europe now has. I thought that if he used them in the way that he promised to use them, Americans would rise up. The streets would be full. Hasn't happened. David Brooks, the conservative New York Times correspondent, he's wondering why the streets aren't full of people protesting. Well, they're not.
No.
And I think the answer is, for most of middle-class America, I mean, they are protesting, but it's nothing like the civil rights movement or the anti-Vietnam demonstrations.
There are no million-man marches, are there, or million-person marches? No one's going to the Washington Monument and making dramatic speeches like Martin Luther King about Donald Trump. So fundamentally, he has his finger on a pulse, doesn't he?
He does, and part of the pulse is rather weak. That's the pulse of Democrat-voting middle-class Americans who are thinking they're outraged, but I think they've tuned out. And I think, you see, I don't think people are necessarily quite as democratic as they say they are. I think they'll put up with a certain amount of autocracy. They won't ask questions all the time. They'll think it's outrageous that he has deported, as at last count, close to 300,000 people without any due process at all, that he's actually flying hundreds of people to countries that they have no connection with at all and dumping them there, like Ghana or Azerbaijan or wherever. That he's doing, that he's closed down Departments of Justice, Department of Education, so on, that he's, what he's doing with the environment and so on. If that's not affecting your job in the United States, well, just get on with your life. That's what I think people are doing. So I think we were wrong to think that these sorts of autocratic measures are going to greatly disturb more than those who make it a habit of being, of reading the New York Times every day and being greatly disturbed by erosions of democracy. And I think we also need to bear in mind what a Republican said to me a long while ago, and is quite forcefully, don't imagine that this is a democracy. This is a republic. That's what the war, the Civil War, was fought about. It wasn't to defend democracy, it was to defend the republic. When Lincoln made his famous Gettysburg Address, a whole lot of Americans were outraged that he was talking about slaves as if they were equal. It wasn't the he said it was to defend democracy. Americans, by and large, it's the republic they hang on to. That's what the songs are about. It's the republic which guarantees their freedom. And their freedom, in a sense, is more important than the democratic procedures. And that's what Trump has understood. You can get away with a hell of a lot.
Yes, bind up your wounds, as Lincoln said, after the Civil War. And, you know, we will build a better world. But as to whether that's been the case, I don't know.
Whether the wounds are bound up, I don't. That's quite
true.
That's true.
Yeah, Don, it's been terrific to have your time and company as well. Don Watson's been our guest, author and historian. Of course, he's written many books and many speeches. You'd love America for its speechifying, I know, Don, which is not something that Australians, despite your great contributions, have managed to rise to great heights.
So they do have a way with words, it's true.
They do. Yes, we can, is the most recent example. But as you say, that's not Donald Trump, but then again, he has his finger on another pulse. His book is called The Shortest History of the United States of America, and if you wanted a survey which is very entertaining and interesting, then and insightful, then have a look. Don Watson has been our guest. Thanks for your time, Don. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.